Chapter 2. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Part 2. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. One of the comma pillars of the Gnostic message of salvation is the realization of the existence of the two nature orders. One nature order, which we know and where we live and have our being, is an order composed of two halves of existence on both sides of the veil, which are fated to merge ever more closely as events develop. The second nature order is unknown to us. We do not live and do not have our being in it, and we are unable to fathom its laws and coherence. The man in the street has no inkling whatsoever of its existence. In Gnostic philosophy, we call the nature order, which is known to us, dialectics, an order under whose laws everything perpetually changes into its opposite. The unknown nature order is called statics, an order in which dialectics does not exist, where everything that exists is eternal and which is governed by entirely different natural and spiritual laws. The Gnostic philosophy designates the unknown nature order as the real one, which is included in the divine plan, as the world of mankind, wherein man lives in a state of beatitude and exaltation, not without a physical body, as is the case on yonder side of the veil of death, but in possession of a glorified material body. We and our fellow man have fallen from this world, and we find ourselves in a certain emergency order, the all-governing principle of which is relativity, a relativity from which, logically, dialectics must be born. Both these nature orders, which are diametrically opposed, are contained within one globe, our Mother Earth, which is the most important of the endless series of mysteries surrounding us. Relatively seen, the spiritual teachings and the discoveries of modern natural science approach one another. Therefore, we once undertook to demonstrate that the unknown nature order must of necessity be contained within our globe. At that time, we started from the discoveries of Professors Lorentz, Einstein, De Sitter, and Clay. With their theories of relativity and considerations about cosmic rays, heat spheres, contracting and expanding universes, they entirely corroborated the ancient wisdom. In those considerations, we called the highest heat sphere, one of the outermost planes of our globe, the domain of original mankind, that part of mankind which did not participate in the fall. The nature order known to us must be seen as an inner sphere of this globe, and our firmament as a planetary one contained within that sphere as an extremely faint shadow of the real universe. By that other nature order, which is unknown to us, we do not mean a heavenly world, a civilized human kingdom, but an absolutely different world, whose aspects cannot in any respect be compared with this world, aspects which cannot arise from this world by any evolutionary development. The two worlds of which we speak are diametrically opposed to one another, although they are contained within one cosmos, within one globe. When several years ago the Hierophants of the Light instructed us to proclaim this teaching, a teaching which has such a very great number of liberating aspects, we were perfectly aware that if only with regard to the above point of view, our work would be a very difficult one. This assumption has indeed come true. In the beginning, positive refutations were all that came our way, and only very few persons have been capable of assimilating it consciously and dynamically. Our mission is to form the nucleus for a universal brotherhood which is not of this world, not of this nature order, but one which in essence and vibration will be wholly attuned to that other nature order, that unknown world. We cannot impose belief in that new world, Kafar Salama, the realm of peace, nor can we show that other world. Yet skepticism and unbelief have not been able to thwart the formation of that Gnostic nucleus, as is fully proven in the work of the spiritual school of the modern Rosicross. The teaching regarding the two nature orders has again been presented to the world, because a sufficient number of persons has once more become mature enough to receive it. There are those who are through experimenting with their humanistic endeavors. They have come to discover that they are dwellers of Ephesus, i.e., bound by the limitations of a form of goodness which can turn into its opposite at any moment. There are those who realize and experience this, who are moreover deeply religious, and consequently they are aware that such a corrupted state cannot possibly have been in God's plan. They have become mature for this teaching in their blood souls, and it opens to them a conscious insight into their true calling as children of God. It is for such persons that we must speak and testify. As for others who, for whatever reason, persist in their dissenting attitude, we commit them to the future. That which the Spirit cannot as yet reveal must be gained in the school of experience. We only hope and pray that if you cannot as yet enter the Gnostic field of harvest, and therefore no kinship of spirit exists between us, we may nevertheless be able to be honest and brotherly towards one another. History has taught us that the suggestions from the distant kingdom create animosity, hatred, and suspicion in many who do not understand them, and even spur them to aggression. Many souls are then besmirched and dragged into the mire, the more so since the new yet ancient divine demand is being made on both friend and foe alike, without any distinction. In our long years of practice on the altar of service, we have broken off friendships for God's sake, severed ties for Jesus' sake, and the Holy Spirit has frequently guided us on the path of loneliness. The experiences of the time when it was granted us to proclaim the teachings of the distant kingdom have left deep traces in our beings. When the current of the universal doctrine flows towards mankind through its servants, the immaculate blazon of these workers is soiled by every variety of accusation. If this happens, then the divine spring from which the workers draw is also denied in many ways, and the attempt is made to pollute the living water. The eye, with its perfidious promptings, always becomes very dangerous when it is unmasked and its expectations thwarted. Throughout the history of the world, the experience of all workers in the vineyard has been the same, and no one who approaches mankind with the teaching of the two nature orders should expect that he will fare any different from Mani. Mani was an exalted teacher in the 3rd century and a devoted servant of Jesus Christ. A great part of his doctrine and his writings have been destroyed by the Roman Catholic bishops under the leadership of Augustine. Mani was murdered and beheaded, and his head, filled with sawdust, was impaled at the top of a pole at one of the gates of a Persian city as a sinister symbol of how empty-headed Mani was supposed to have been. Augustine, one of the founders of the Roman Catholic Church, associated himself with the Manichaeans as he desired to be initiated into their mysteries. However, the mysteries and values of the distant kingdom are known only to fundamentally renewed human beings, which was nowhere near the case with regard to Augustine. Consequently, as he found the doors closed to him, everywhere he, as a dialectical man, received the very opposite of what he was seeking. He left the order with the comment, "Never did I find any proof of an actually existing second nature order." As a reaction to his spiritual bankruptcy, he proceeded with an effort to establish a Christ realm in this nature order. Being one of the founders of the Roman hierarchy, he had in mind to replace what he had been unable to attain by an earthly theocracy. Psychoanalysis was still unknown in those days. Otherwise, it would have been clear that an initial disappointment accounts for a following reaction. Augustine's activity is continued in modem garb by the order of the Jesuits. Thus we can see how the ancient Judas drama has been repeated up to the present day. Judas too desired an earthly theocracy under the guidance of his beloved master Jesus. However, when Jesus declared that his kingdom was not of this world, Judas tried to force him. Two nature orders are contained within our earthly cosmos. The great mission of Christianity is to liberate us from the fallen nature order with its consciousness, soul, and body, and to liberate us likewise with regard to our consciousness, soul, and body to the freedom of the original nature order. This regeneration must proceed from below upwards, and this is why Jesus Christ came to dwell among us, to establish the link, to set up the ladder, the Mercurialis, whereby the pupil may ascend to the distant kingdom. The bankruptcy of the Christian communities in this world is earned by a wrong interpretation of the binding of Christ with this world and its fallen mankind, and to the continued attempt to establish an earthly kingdom. Those who are still able to see and to hear proceed therefore to build a new Gnostic structure. They endeavor to fulfill the mission of Christ within themselves, and therefore they ascend the mountain with him, so that they may understand his teachings and the program of self-activity. Since the founding of this nature order ascending the mountain, the Meru, the Mount of the Gods, symbolizes one's capacity to receive certain teachings or divine suggestions. Places of initiation were always to be found in the mountains. Every nation had its sacred mountain, and there still exist sacred mountains where great spiritual beings dwell. From of old, there are legends of the seven mountains, which are the abodes of the seven spirits. This is an allusion to the seven holy cosmic forces that concern themselves with man. These cosmic forces, which work through prophets and teachers, and which radiate in fullness through Jesus Christ, watch the approaching multitudes for those who seek for the true spirit, those who came to the mountain and assemble. Then they teach them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." We may not make platitudes of the Beatitudes. Indeed, it is as Uspensky says, "The Gospel in general and the Sermon on the Mount in particular were not written for the masses, but for those who participate in a group with inner consciousness." It remains to be seen whether in the Bible or in any other sacred book, anything at all could be found that is intended for those who remain on the plane of dialectic nature. The Word of the Lord, freed from all theological inventions, is intended for those who can see and understand, and who have reached a certain inner state of spiritual craving. To them, the counsel is given to become poor in spirit, as an initial stage of being upon the path of self-realization. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Several years ago, we visited a mental institution. In one of the cottages reserved for patients suffering from softening of the brain, we met the chaplain. In pointing out the poor creatures who were in all stages of degeneration, many of whom had reached a sub-animal condition, he said to us, "And yet, especially to such as these are addressed the words spoken by our Lord, blessed are the poor in spirit." We looked at this minister in utter amazement. He was very honest. Ever since we have wondered who was to be more pitied, the patients in their plight of unconsciousness or that clergyman. Certain Bible exegetes have declared that the original manuscript of the Sermon on the Mount must have read, "Blessed are the poor." They supposed that this translation had been so exploited by the propertied class, and that the oppressed class, who would rather not be blessed at all, rebelled so vigorously that the translation has been changed to read, "poor in spirit." This was said to have given satisfaction to both parties concerned, and to have been a concession made for the sake of the social equilibrium. Blessed are the poor in spirit. This is the first necessary state of being for all who desire to walk the path of regeneration. Those who approach the mountain have come to a deadlock in this world. While living, they have died with respect to this nature. They have ceased to expect anything from this world, and they have no mind to pursue any further dialectical ambitions, except to pay the inevitable price for their presence in this nature. They inwardly experience the presence of a reality other than this disorder, but they do not yet know it. They have heard the call and they react to it. They come nearer to the source, but cannot yet reach the living water itself. They cannot approach the new reality, for they do not as yet possess an adequate quality of spirit and soul to do so. It appears that their I is a delusion. They do not possess an inner spirit, but only a certain consciousness, a biological instinct with a thinking capacity. They know themselves to be human animals, so there is a great craving within them, an intense need for light and force. They search and struggle for the true spirit, which is theirs, but which is denied them. They crave for the spirit which would be able to pronounce a new creative fiat. They seek for a door, but they cannot find it. They are in profound soul anguish, in great dismay, and overcome by a feeling of emptiness. They are conscious of being poor in spirit. They have lost their self-confidence, and all their bragging has been driven out of them. They have become very unpretentious. They know their poverty of spirit, and at the same time their unsatisfied craving for the spirit. When this psychological state, born of blood and tears, born out of life itself, has reached a crisis, the seeker is lifted up to the mountain, and he hears the voice saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." The condition of being nothing, not willing anything, and not able to be anything, together with the profound need of the new fulfillment, create the primary condition for the binding with the distant, and yet so very near, kingdom. Hence, this poverty in spirit is the primary condition on the way to self-realization. We hope and pray that you may struggle successfully through this poverty, so as to reach an understanding of its deeper meaning. With all our arrogance stripped away, with all our self-confidence smashed to bits, with the bragging of the I ended and our madness unmasked, having become very modest and yet very determined sparks of humanity, that is the state of consciousness that is poor in spirit. That is the gate to the distant and unknown realm of light, to the static nature order. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.